this morning alone calls into question my right maybe to even be or qualifications to be in teaching something like a weekend on marriage, as I think about it being Mother's Day and knowing that I have stranded the mother of my three children in Kansas City while I'm in Asheville, North Carolina. We did at least make those arrangements in agreement, I would have you know, before I came this weekend. It's really been good to be here, and what I want us to do this morning is think, we're kind of taking this lesson, which possibly could even follow the next lesson instead of precede it. The next lesson, the one during our worship period, is going to be on the covenant nature of marriage, which I keep at that time period because I feel it is the most important of the lessons that we look at. It is so foundational and so fundamental that it becomes absolutely key. But if we will just accept for the time being, for this lesson, that marriage is a covenant and that it is a lifetime agreement, then this lesson is based on the idea of what does it take to accomplish that. If I'm living in a world when or where large numbers of marriages are failing, if I live in a world where even the brethren that I know have in way too large a numbers marriages that are failing, how am I going to get where I need to be? We've got a couple in our congregation that have been married 69 years. And it's easy, at least when I'm teaching, and they sit over here for me when we're at home, to just point at them and say, don't tell me that God's plan can't work, because here's evidence that God's plan can work, and it can work gloriously, but how do I get there? I mean, I've been married 34, and I think we've got a great marriage, but 34 to 69, if the Lord allows us to live that long, is still a long way. That's longer left than what we've got so far, marriage. How do I get to that point? How is it that I secure a covenant marriage? And so this lesson is entitled, What Every Marriage Requires. How is it that I'm going to get to where I need to be? Thank you so much for being here. I need to ask a very, very important question at the front end of this lesson. Are there bells that will be rung? Are there people that will hurl spears or anything? I mean, how will I know when my time is over?
There will be a bell at 5 minutes till time to quit.
Okay. So better quit. If I don't end at the second bell, that's when things happen. I understand that. So we're going to look at this morning in four points. Four keys to keeping the covenant. That's what we want to talk about. What are things that I need to do to make sure that this works the way that God intends? Because it's not only disturbing that marriages dissolve, that's disturbing enough, but it's disturbing that there are many Christians, even though their marriages are together, that there are Christians that don't have marriages that are absolutely thriving, marriages that are enjoying the incredible blessings that God intends come through marriage. I know numerous couples that struggle, and their marriages may endure. They may not come to an end through dissolution, but they do struggle from day one, it seems like sometimes all the way through, and it's more of an endurance project than it is enjoying the bliss of the relationship. And if I should enjoy my relationship with God as a part of His church, if I should enjoy and have true contentment and real bliss because I am God's child, because I am married to God in relationship to Him, then if that's a picture that is painted from marriage in Ephesians chapter 5, marriage should be that way. I mean, it should be extremely joyful. That doesn't mean there aren't hard times. Jesus, as we mentioned, was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, but He was a man of great joy and asked that His disciples be able to have His joy. That's what my life should be like, not only with my God, that's what my life should be like with my wife as well. How do we accomplish that? We're going to talk about four goals, and here's the way they're going to go. There's going to be a mindset followed by an action, and a mindset followed by an action, because I think that's the way God has us do all things. God says, I've got to get you to think a certain way first. If you'll think a certain way, then you can act a certain way. And then He says, if I can get you to think a certain way again, then I'll get you to act a certain way. So we're going to have a mindset followed by an action, a mindset followed by an action in this particular lesson. And I think these things are critical to making a marriage work. First, decide on your goals. This is absolutely critical to having a marriage work. It amazes me that people sit down as married couples that don't sit down and just say, where is it that we want to go with our marriage? What do we want to do? What kind of relationship do we want to have? What is it that we're trying to build in our relationship one with another. You really need to set goals. What is the purpose for setting goals? What do goals do for you? They're going to help you strive for something. They give me something to look at, don't they? In other words, as you think about the relationship that we have with God, we're told in Hebrews chapter 12, if you want to look at that passage, in Hebrews chapter 12, it's talking about Jesus Christ. Jesus endured the cross. We're told that. We know that. And his disciples didn't do so well during that time period, did they? You know, the disciples all fled from Jesus. You remember Jesus telling them, watch and pray? They didn't do so good at watching and praying. They fell asleep. Jesus prayed. Came back and told them, watch and pray. They fell asleep again. Jesus prayed. He tells them, watch and pray. They fall asleep again. Jesus prayed. That's important to understand. He didn't endure the cross because he was God. He didn't do that with some ability that was supernatural that we don't have access to. Hebrews chapter 12 tells us how he endured the cross. What does it tell us in Hebrews chapter 12? How he endured the cross. Despising shame. He says what? Oh, man, anticipating the joy. It says, for the joy that was set before him. Jesus never lost sight of the picture. And that becomes critically important if you're going to achieve a goal. Goals give us direction. That they help us understand where it is that I'm going. There's a man by the name of Les Parot that said, if you don't know what port you're headed for, no wind is a good wind. I used to sail and boat a lot in Florida. And they would talk about good winds and bad winds. But, you know, every wind you can sail in. You know, before I ever started sailing, I thought, well, you need to sail with the wind. Well, you don't. You can sail into the wind. You just have to do what they call tacking. You're going back and forth at 45s. The wind comes behind your sail and pushes you, even though it's blowing at your face. But that's not considered a good wind. You're not going to go as fast that way when you're tacking back and forth as you are if you're able to have a wind behind you and just be moving forward. But if you don't know where it is you want to go, if somebody says, hey, is it a good wind today? How would you know if it's a good wind? I don't know where I want to go. And that's the nature of marriage. How do I know what's good and what's not good for my marriage if I don't know where I want to go with my marriage? We have to set some goals. They give us direction. Secondly, goals also keep us focused, like Jesus. It allows me to see where it is that I'm going. Your marriage has to be the top priority in this life outside your relationship with God himself. It has to be. It is the one relationship that God intends last throughout your entire life once you're married. Now, we have three sons. They are all three still our sons. But whether I like it or don't like it, the nature of the leave and cleave principles in Genesis chapter 2 tell me that my sons, though they are still our sons, are no longer primarily our sons. Why? Because all three of them are married. Primarily, they are somebody's husband. They are in a new household. There is a new union. They have left our household that they might cleave to their spouse and create this new union. That has taken top priority. And as much as I love my children, as much as we know that our children love us, we are not their top priority and cannot be their top priority. Their spouse has to be. It has to be top priority. That's why it deserves our focus. Now, why is that critical? Why, as you think about goals, is that absolutely critical? Here's one of the things when people talk to me about selecting a mate. Because I used to get to ask that question a lot of times about who do you want your boys to marry? That was always the easiest question for me to answer. I didn't have particular names. I didn't want to tell them, you need to pick this one because I like her. She gets along with us well. I like her manners. That wasn't the issue at all. What I tried to impress on my children over and over and over again. Here's what you need to do first. You need to set your goal in life. Spiritually, you need to set your goal in life. And that's critical. Because if I couldn't convince my children that the main goal they should have in life is to please God so that they can someday enjoy heaven with God and all of his children, then I haven't impressed on them the most important thing in life. serving and pleasing God had to be the most fundamental goal in their life. And you try to impress them with that fact. So if that is the case, and I've convinced my children that serving God is the most important thing that they need to do, what automatically becomes the first idea in mind when we start talking about marriage is if your goal is to get from where you are. When I was in Huntsville doing a meeting, I drove by a church building, don't remember what faith it was. They had a sermon title up front. I thought, there's a good sermon title. It said, How to Get to Heaven from Huntsville. I thought, that's a good sermon title. That's what, if you're living in Huntsville, that's what you want to know, how to get to heaven from Huntsville. If your goal is to get to heaven, spend eternity with God, what would make you think that choosing somebody with an alternate goal is going to help you in that? Why is it critically important to choose somebody as a mate, if you're not married yet, to choose somebody as a mate that has as their goal also the pursuit of God above and beyond all other things? Because if that is my goal, that's the only way I'm going to get assistance in that area. It becomes critically important to choose your mate based on their goal in life. Is godliness their goal? And so when I'm counseling with young couples, there's a lot of other things, and that's exactly what God told the Israelites, wasn't it? He said, you know what's going to be the problem if you marry outside of your mindset spiritually? They're going to take you away from me, not closer to me. It becomes critically important to understand that goals are important. And then for the married couples that are already married as well, you have to have the goals. Where do I want to be? You know, I would just ask you in your own mind, not to answer me, but in your own mind, how many of you have sat down on a year-by-year basis and said, here's what we want to grow in this year in our marriage. We're going to set some real goals. Here's the things that we're going to want to do. We want to grow in these areas, and this is how we're going to do that. We just don't do that the way we do in some other areas of life. The plan that goes with that, or the development of an action that goes with that, is to think in terms of, once I've set that top priority, once I have made that the most important thing, that I've got to set some boundaries. If you've got a goal, you have to set boundaries. Why is that the case? So you can stay on track. And so boundaries cause, what's the difficulty if I don't set any boundaries at all? I get distracted. I've got a lesson that I preach sometimes called Satan's Weapons of Mass Distraction. I think that's one of his most valid ways of working in our lives. It's not always a full frontal attack. Sometimes he just divert your attention. If I can just divert your attention, I can accomplish what I want to accomplish. And I'm saying that's the mindset of Satan. We need to not stay distracted. We've got to set boundaries. I've got to stay within some parameters. I can't. If career is the most important thing to me, my marriage cannot be. I can't have two most important things to me. If my recreation is the most important thing to me, my marriage cannot be. If other things, as my friends maybe, are the most important thing to me, my marriage cannot be. I have to set boundaries, and it's almost like making a to-do list kind of thing. I've got to set something at the top of the list. Prioritizing becomes absolutely critical. Secondly, you need to develop a plan. What's the difference between a plan and a goal? A plan has directions. Earl? All right, the goal is the mindset, the plan. So as I'm looking at the directions, kind of like a blueprint. We understand that, don't we? You know, as you were to just say, you know what, I got in my mind what I would like this house to look like. You're not going to find many contractors who are going to say, yeah, you know what, if you'll just kind of stand on the corner and guide me as I go, I'll just build you a house here. It's not likely to work very well, is it? It's funny, as you've watched people, when I just teach my kids, they say math has got no purpose in life at all. You know, they went through that kind of mentality. Why am I studying these things in school kind of thing? I always loved math. I mean, I thought that was great. Geometry proofs were some of the great joys of my life, to be able to just work those proofs out. And they said, you'll never be able to use any of that. And so I had them go out in the backyard. I said, here's what I need you guys to do. I need you to take some strings or some rope we had. I said, I need you to string me out a volleyball court. Here's the dimensions of it. And so they did that. They tried to string that out, and they did the dimensions. And I said, yeah, but this side's longer than this side. Or and then it would step back. I said, look, it's not straight. This one looks like it's at a 90-degree angle, but it's not. It's way less than that. How are you going to do that? Eventually, they had to understand there had to be a way to go corner to corner geometrically, and you had to know what that dimension was. That was the dimension I didn't give them. It is the idea of you've got to have plans. You have to be able to map something out, lay something out. A goal is what you need to be. A plan is what you need to do in order to be what you need to be. That becomes critical in marriage. What kind of plans do we have? Judy and I sit down and talk about our goals on a year-by-year basis. And we set goals for a year. We set goals for farther down the road than a year. So as you set the goal, how am I going to get where I need to be? Because if I don't do that, then I'm going to struggle from that someday syndrome. How many people in here have ever said, you know what, spiritually, a goal? I need to read the Bible more than I'm reading the Bible. You ever set that goal in your mind? How many of you have ever set that goal and not accomplished that goal the next year? We read differently. I read by numbers of pages because I just make sure that I read a certain amount of pages every day. And that's just the way I've always trained myself to read. So I'm reading that way and over and over. She doesn't. She reads by a daily Bible reading list. You've all seen those. She checks them off. That is incredibly helpful to her because she can see exactly today this is what I've got to read, and she checks it off. But there's a plan, and she has for, I have no idea now how long. I'm guessing the last 15 or 20 years. She's read through the Bible every single year without fail, every year over and over by that method. But there's a plan. If all she said was, I want to read more, it's the same way with prayer. I hear people say, you know what, I need to pray more often than I pray. But if you don't make a plan for that, if you don't say, you know what, I'm going to set aside this particular time every day to spend in prayer, then it's not going to happen. Families sometimes say, we need to have more devotions. We need to read the Bible together more. You have to have a plan for that. You have to say, we're going to read it this time. We're going to spend this time together. That's the nature of marriage. If you're going to get from here to there in your marriage, you have to have some kind of plan to accomplish that. This man, Les Parade, also says, make no mistake, you'll never achieve your ideal marriage as a mere passenger. You and your partner must have your hands on the wheel. I like that quote. It's not going to work if either one of you thinks you're just going to ride. It's going to take both of you. We sit down and just have long discussions about setting goals. Where do we want to be? Where do we want to be evangelistically in our marriage this year? What do we want to accomplish this year evangelistically as we're reaching out to friends and neighbors, that kind of thing? And then we sit down and say, so exactly how are we going to do that? Where are we going to be spiritually in our development together? How are we going to do that? Where do we want to be financially at the end of this year? And how are we going to do that? And then it's the ability to set that plan in front of you. I love what one man, he said, hell is to drift, heaven is to steer. That is absolutely the truth. Shirley Walker, Ralph Walker's mother, used to continually, because I was kind of the prodigal son that they had. I stayed with them. It took them a little over 3 years to teach me the gospel and convince me to do right. And there were a lot of things I did that weren't just not right. They were very wrong during that time period of my life. And I would always tell, because Shirley would always say to me, and she'd probably shoot me if she heard me call her Shirley to the group. So Mrs. Walker would always say to me that I needed to change the way I was doing things. And I would always say, you know what, Mrs. Walker, I'm going to do that. To which I heard, I can't tell you how many times, followed by a statement like that that I would make. She would say, well, just remember, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I thought, man, that is so true. Intending to get somewhere isn't going to get you there. Setting a plan, developing a plan, having a way. And there's ways that you can do that. First, you need to, if you're going to set that successful course, charting that course successfully, you're going to need to ask for divine guidance. In Psalm 127, we're told, unless the Lord builds the house, what? They labor in vain. He's saying, if you're not doing it God's way, then you're not going to get where you need to get. The Lord has to build this house. This isn't me. You know, God tells me a lot of things, like there's some things that I think are right, but that isn't what makes them right. He determines what's right, and he says, you need to follow You need to follow my plan. You need to make sure that you're heading the right direction. Isn't it interesting that as you look back in the Old Testament and watch some of the battles that the Israelites went through, there were battles that they won without any difficulty at all, weren't there? I mean, some incredible battles that they won without any difficulty at all. There were other battles immediately following that that they lost miserably. What was the difference between the two? Same army, same weapons, same skills. That didn't seek the guidance of God. Is this what we're supposed to do? Or are you going to be with us? Every time God was not sought, either by the nation or by the man, man starts heading the wrong direction. It does not work the way he plans on it working. It's going to be the same in your household. You need to know what God wants you to be as a husband, as a wife, what he wants you to be as a family. You need to live inside his word. You need to make sure that, your Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3 and all the other things where you can read about what God says you're supposed to be, you need to be living inside of that, abiding in that, dwelling in God's word to make sure that you're getting where you need to go. Secondly, you got to consider what matters most. Jesus said in Mark chapter 8 that, Jesus was very bottom line. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, God's very bottom line. He says, let's just consider the bottom line here. He said, so if you gain the whole world and lose your soul, was it worth it? Isn't that what he's saying? He said, let's just be bottom line. Let's suppose I give you everything. Everything you've ever dreamed of. You get the whole world, but you lose your soul. Bottom line, you lose, don't you? He's very bottom line. He's saying, somebody's going to have to consider what matters most. I've got to learn to prioritize in my marriage. Not just prioritize my marriage, but prioritize in my marriage. A lady by the name of Michelle Wiener Davis, who wrote and writes on marriage, she's a counselor and an author. She writes these words. The number one cause for the breakdown of marriages today is the same issue that causes infidelity. Couples aren't prioritizing their marriage. People spend time on their careers, their kids, community affairs, hobbies, sports, but they take their spouses for granted. It just doesn't work that way. No question about that. Nothing more important than prioritizing inside your marriage to make sure that you're doing things right. One of the things that you watch is you're going to have to understand there's a lot of things pulling at your life. How many people in here use a day planner, to-do list, something like that? Let's see a show of hands. How many of you have ever opened your day planner or looked at your to-do list and immediately knew, I can't get this all done today? You ever done that? So the very next step has to be what? I have to prioritize. I have to understand what it is that's going to fall off. Because if I acknowledge I can't get it all done today, what I'm saying is I've got to pick something on the list that isn't getting done. Isn't that right? I have to make that choice because it can't all be done today. We sometimes want to do it all. I can tell you, if your marriage is going to be good, your children do not have to play 3 sports, 2 musical instruments, be involved in karate, and 3 other things. They can run you ragged. I'm not saying having your children involved in things is in and of itself bad. What I'm saying is, if your children become the priority of your marriage no longer is. You can't let that happen. We have to understand, I have to keep control of those things. Our kids were involved in things, and we went through a period where we wrestled mightily with that. Our kids played baseball in Temple Terrace, Florida. One of the years that they played baseball, they played a 50-game season. Our kids were 10, 11, and 12. They played a 50-game season. That was 2 games every week, 2 practices every week. Because of their ages, they were on 3 separate teams, so that meant 6 games every week, 6 practices every single week. It consumed for a period of time our life. We were at the baseball field every spare hour of every day, finally just said, can't do it. Too much is being sacrificed in order to accomplish this. You're going to have to make those kinds of choices. So once you decide what matters most, you have to decide what changes. What am I going to drop? What am I going to do differently? How am I going to keep this from tearing up my life? That's the plan. The plan says I've got to decide what matters most, and then I've got to decide what's getting eliminated because I can't accomplish it all. I need to focus on my marriage. Just learning to say no becomes critically important. I can tell you from a preacher's standpoint, there's a great difficulty associated with that. Sometimes there's a tendency to feel like you need to respond to everybody that calls and asks for help. But what do I gain if, in fact, my marriage is sacrificed for the benefit of helping somebody else? God says you still have to prioritize. You have to decide. I've committed to my wife certain things. God expects me to fulfill that, as we'll see in the next section. And then finally, in this area, set some short-term goals. You have to get there in smaller steps. I remember when I first wanted to dramatically change my prayer life was when I read a statement about some of the old-time people that talked about their prayer, Martin Luther even, and some of those. And he had a quote one time where he said that he had so much to do that he felt compelled to start every day with 2 hours of prayer. I have to tell you, when I first read that, I thought, something's backwards about this. I've got so much to do, I can barely get in any prayer time, I'm thinking. He's saying, I got so much to do, I better start with 2 hours of prayer. But I thought, 2 hours of prayer. That was the thing that really hit me. I thought, I had never at that time prayed for 2 hours in any kind of continual manner. And this guy's saying he starts every day with 2 hours of prayer. So I thought, here's what I did. I said, you know what? Tomorrow, I'm going to start with 2 hours of prayer. Can't tell you how miserably that failed. If you've never prayed for more than 10 minutes, praying for 2 hours just doesn't happen just because you want it to happen. So I changed the goals and set some short-term goals. And I'm going to spend 30 minutes in prayer on this day, and then I'm going to read and spend 30 more, whatever the case is, setting some short-term goals to get you from here to there. You're not going to change your marriage tomorrow, but you can start to change your marriage tomorrow. And that's what we need to do, is set some short-term goals. Thirdly, determine to commit. This is what your wedding vows are all about. That's what matters. It is the idea of making sure that I've got a mindset that says, I'm going to do this no matter what. That's commitment. That's a mindset. And there's some enemies of commitment. We need to understand that commitment is a choice. Overcommitment is an enemy to commitment. Commitment is a choice. I get to pick what is most important to me, and I can make the determination to do that. I can say, this will be what I focus on. I can do that. Jesus' disciples failed at that, but Jesus never lost sight of that. When he was in that garden, there was no question what he remained focused on, because he was absolutely, totally committed to that, and he had a plan in order to accomplish that. And he was on his knees and praying before God in order that he could keep that mindset. We need to make sure that we do that. Selfishness is the other part. It requires time and sacrifice from us. Because of the selfishness involved, I've got to determine my marriage won't get better unless I devote some real time to it. That's just the nature of that. And we'll talk a little bit more about the nature of commitment in the next section. And then finally, I want you to think about this one just a little bit. The idea of the dedication to finish. That's not just the commitment. Marriage sometimes goes well, sometimes doesn't go so well. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not so easy. There have been times in our married life where there were just absolutely no bumps at all. That was before we had any children, and has only occurred again after the children were all gone from the home. There are bumps in marriage. We understand. There's difficulties in marriage. And I don't mean severe difficulties always. There's just bumps. That's just the nature of a relationship. But there are times that that's not the case. It's just been very easy to walk. Anybody in here do things like treadmill work or run in order to try and take care of your health? Anybody do that? I do treadmill. Sometimes I run, although I have to tell you, it has always been a major principle in my life. If there's not somebody chasing you, there is no reason to run. So you're not going to find me out just running for the sake of running very frequently. But I do get on treadmill only because the doctor says you need to be doing certain things, make sure you keep your heart in condition, that kind of thing. Can't tell you how badly I hate stepping onto the treadmill. And I've been doing it for quite a while, and it's never changed. People say, you know what, you're going to get to where you really like that. Now, I like the way I feel as soon as I shut the treadmill off for multiple reasons. One, because the treadmill's shut off and I'm stepping off of it, but also because I know it did do something for me. But I hate every minute I'm on the treadmill. I try to get past that. I can't get past it. But I'm determined that I'm going to keep pushing forward because there's a result I'm interested in. It's what I'm going to get out of that that makes the difference. It isn't that I say, you know what, this isn't difficult. And because of my attitude toward it, I'm sure sometimes it's much more difficult than it would be if I took a different attitude. But I, as I'm jogging on the treadmill and changing speeds and changing incline, there are sometimes that I cover up the clock, because the worst thing I can do is see how much time I've got left, because it's never short enough. So because if I was looking at it and it said, you've got 12 minutes left, I'd just quit. I'd say, I can't do 12 more minutes. I know that. So I cover it up and I just wait till it beeps and tells me you're done. But it's difficult. It requires a dedication. It's the idea of sometimes in marriage, to move requires you putting one foot in front of the other. Sometimes it's nice big strides, but sometimes it's saying, you know what, I've got to take the next little step, and I'm making sure I'm moving forward, and I continue to do that. I've got to have the dedication to finish what I start. That is not just the mindset, that is the action. Dedication is not just how I think, it's what I'm doing to accomplish that. It is putting that one foot forward after the other. It's getting past those bumps. That requires certain things. It requires patience. That requires patience from me. I mean, it isn't always just without any resistance at all in marriage. Whether it's the children, I mean, anybody that has or is raising children understands patience at a whole new level than you would have before. Would you agree with that? I mean, it takes patience to live with children. But it took patience for my kids to live with me, too. I know that. You know, relationships require that kind of patience. And we just wrestle. We don't have a lot of patience, do we? I mean, typically. Not a lot of people have lots of patience. Loved a story I read about a guy whose car stalled. He's at a light. His car stalled. And as the case with a lot of people, the guy behind him couldn't get around him, so he's just laying on his horn. He's beeping and beeping. The guy's trying to start his car. Keeps trying to start his car. It won't start. The guy behind him keeps beeping and beeping. And so the guy gets out of his car, you know, and it sounds like it's going to be one of those road rage incidents, but it's not. He gets out of his car, walks back to the car behind him, taps on the guy's window. The guy rolls his window down. He says, hey, tell you what. He says, if you can go up and try and start my car, I'll sit back here and honk your horn for you. We don't have a lot of patience. I know when Judy and I go grocery shopping, it's almost like a game. You turn the corner on the last aisle, and we're viewing the cash registers. Who's got the shortest line? And even if it's the shortest line, that cashier's slow. Do not get in that line. That may cost us a couple of minutes. I flip on a computer sometimes, and I think, are you kidding? It has taken 7 seconds for this program to open. We lose the patience. But it takes patience. It is somebody saying, you know what? I'm just going to have to calm the spirit a little bit if I'm going to be able to accomplish this. I'm going to have to think about this a little bit differently. It takes patience in order to grow in that relationship. Numerous times did I understand that with my children over and over again. And if there was no patience, where would the relationship be? And I would only ask you the same thing about God. If there was no patience in God's relationship with us, where would we be? Where would we be? Secondly, it requires endurance. That becomes critical. That's not just patience like in the short term. That's just saying you've got to be willing to bear up under a weight. Over and over again, you have to bear up under a weight, something sitting on your shoulders. When you read about Job in the book of James, we sometimes say consider the patience of Job. It's not really the patience. Not like that patience of how fast does that line move kind of patience. I mean, that isn't what Job was living with. The idea there really is consider the endurance of Job. Because item after item after item that were absolutely critical and crucial hit Job right in the face, and Job still maintained his faith. That was endurance. Can you imagine the weight of getting the news that Job got? Can you just imagine? Have you ever gotten bad news? And you just know what a weight it put on you? And how it burdened you, and even if you dealt with that weight, you still know it just was a burden when you first got the news. Imagine getting the news that Job got. No wonder, he said to his friends, sorry, counselors are you all, but they didn't start out that way. They came and just sat with him for days. Why? Because they had no idea what to say. What do you say to somebody that's carrying that kind of burden? There's nothing good to say. Job endured incredibly. We need to do that. That is that literal idea of picking up one foot and putting it down and picking up, because I refuse to stop walking. Let me leave you with this illustration and just one more statement. If few years back, we went to Colorado in a large group for a trip. A group of us, about seven of us in the group, decided we were going to do a mountain summit hike. I had never done that before. I mean, I enjoyed hiking and things of that nature. Hadn't really thought much about what it was going to be like. I remember asking the guide, how long will it take us? He said, it's a little over 4 miles from where you're starting to where you're going. He said, so it's going to take you just right at 4 hours, or just maybe a fraction longer to get there, and about 2 hours or 2.5 to come back down. I thought, this guy's lost his mind. 4 miles, and it's going to take us 4 hours or a little bit longer to walk it? That can't be. Have you ever gotten on a treadmill and walked at 1 mile an hour? If you don't look down, you won't know you're moving. You have to see the floor moving to understand you're even going anywhere at 1 mile per hour. So I thought, that can't be right. The group we were with made the mistake of asking me to lead the group. So we took off at what I would consider a neighborhood pace, probably 3.5 miles per hour, I would guess. 9 minutes, 59 seconds into our hike, all seven of us were sitting on a fallen tree, a big log, sucking wind as hard as we could, trying to get any oxygen from the air that was around us. We couldn't breathe. This hike started at 10,000 feet, hiked to 13,000 feet. I realized at 10,000 feet, there's a reason you're walking at that pace, because there is no air at 10,000 feet. It was only getting worse. We walked, and we slowed down after that, I assure you. We got back onto a normal pace, and we walked, and you think you're getting close to the summit, and you're not, and it's taking forever. As we got to the top, I literally was walking about from where I am to where Earl is, and stopping for about 30 seconds, and just catching breath, and then walking that distance again, and catching breath. My youngest son, Jonathan, was greatly afraid. He didn't tell me at the time. He told me when we got back down. He was afraid, because I know he thought he was going to have to carry me back down the mountain. That was what really concerned him. But I couldn't find oxygen. Buzzards followed us for the last hour of the hike. They knew what was going on. We summited the mountain. But I can tell you, had we not committed to do that, and had I not determined that whatever it took, I was going to put one foot in front of the other, I would not have made the top of that mountain. And we came back down, and we're all okay since then. But the last for us, for me more than some others, but for all of us, the last probably half a mile of that trip, or at least the last quarter mile, was not easy at all. It was literally just take a few steps and stop, and take a few steps and stop. And something that I learned on a couple occasions, I said, look, you guys go ahead just a little bit, because we could see the summit then. I said, I'll catch up to you. Learned a valuable lesson that I think applies equally to marriage. It's easier to stay up than it is to catch up. You can count on that. Whatever I thought it was costing me to exert when I was walking with them, trying to make up even 10 yards of ground to catch them was excruciating, and it's going to be the same in your marriage. Whatever effort it takes for you to maintain a good marriage, it's going to require way more effort than that to repair and to catch back up to a good marriage. Set your goals now. Develop your plans now. Make the commitment now, and keep the dedication to live by that commitment throughout your marriage life. And I think you'll understand the bliss that God intends that we enjoy through marriage. Thank you guys so much for your attention this morning.